All right, so I'm the last author here. So speaking on behalf of the first author, Dr. Jinghai Quan, I have a fairly long list of co-authors, and a lot of you probably know Farah Fatami, and I don't think she's in the audience today. So I'm going to be speaking on forest and grassland cover increased greenhouse gas emissions during spring thaw in the agricultural landscape in Western Canada. It's already a fairly long title. But greenhouse gases, we are dealing with three different greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide. Obviously, in fact, they have a different response to these agricultural system and land cover treatments. But we'll get into the detail into that. We know globally that agriculture is a really significant source of greenhouse gases. In Canada, in particular, about 10% of the anthropogenic sources of greenhouse gases are coming from agriculture. So with that, we need to really look at ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. Much research has been invested in doing that, in trying to find ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. For example, zero tillage or minimum tillage or other forms of conservation agriculture has been studied and been found to be effective in reducing greenhouse gas emissions or increasing soil carbon storage in the agricultural landscape, but is that enough? Obviously, that's not. And one of the good news is that we find that planting trees in the agricultural landscape in the form of agroforestry has been found to be effective in increasing carbon sequestration in the ecosystem as well as in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But one of the issues we are facing with is while most people measure greenhouse gas emissions during the growing season in the northern latitudes, and particularly in the boreal ecoregion, winter time, the condition obviously is not really conducive for measuring greenhouse gas emissions. And we think greenhouse gas emissions in the winter time is going to be substantial, and in particular when the temperature is rising and the soil moisture is changing as the snow is melting, we think that the fresh greenhouse gases from that spring thaw period can be fairly significant. So, and we don't think anyone has studied greenhouse gas emissions during the spring thaw in agroforestry systems, in particular in Western Canada. And so the objective of this study is to really to look at the impact of different agroforestry systems and land uses within each agroforestry system. Within each agroforestry system, we'll be looking at forested versus agricultural land uses. And so in this particular study, we are dealing with three different agroforestry systems, the hedgerow system, the shelter belt, and the silvopastoral system. The difference between the hedgerow and the shelter belt is that the hedgerow is based on natural vegetation that's been kept on the age of the land of the property where shelter belt is typically planted. And so for this study we had 36 different sites selected across central Alberta, and this map shows the distribution of the research sites. Of all these 36 sites, we had 12 hedgerows, 12 shelter belt, and 12 silvopastoral systems. And the sampling run across 270 kilometers north-south and 226 kilometers as an estimate. Really should be east-west. I don't understand why that's a mistake. So within each site, we had this split plot design. The main plot, obviously, is the agroforestry system. And the split plot is between the tree land use versus the agricultural land use. And within each of these land use systems, we run a transect and we had gas chambers installed, and we also measured moisture and temperature conditions in each of these land use systems. The transect in the agricultural land use system was run about 30 meters away from the trees so that we don't run into the immediate influence of the trees. And the picture over here obviously is an example of a shelter belt system. And so we have a set of fairly complex hypotheses because again we're dealing with three different greenhouse gases, and we predict that the CO2 emission is going to be higher from the tree area than the herb plant. And so we are dealing with the spring thaw period, while in the tree area, a lot of the trees are still growing or green. And so we would expect autotrophic respirations would still be occurring, while in the herb land, here the herb land includes agricultural production systems in the shelter belt and the hedgerow systems, versus the grazed pasture as a comparison for the silvopastoral system. For methane uptake, so this is the uptake or oxidation of methane, and we expect the methane concentration to decrease in a closed chamber over time. And so we expect the methane uptake to be greater in the treed area because of greater diversity of microbial population. That we expect the mesotrophs to be having a higher population in the treed area in the spring thaw period, while the nitrous oxide emission, we would expect that to be higher in the herbland area, largely because of the nitrogen application in the agricultural production system. And that's going to be controlling the nitrous oxide emissions. And we eventually calculate the global warming potential because the nitrous oxide has much higher global warming potential. And because we predicted the nitrous oxide emissions to be higher in the herbland, therefore we predict the global warming potential is going to be higher in the herbland. In terms of the differences among the three agricultural systems, our predictions are CO2 emission is going to be higher in the silvopastoral than in the hedgerow, and the least or the lowest will be in the shelter belt. Similarly, for methane uptake, it's going to be higher in the silvopastoral than in the hedgerow, and the lowest will be in the shelter belt. The nitrous oxide emission, we would not expect a difference between the shelter belt and the hedgerow because we are dealing largely agricultural production systems in the agricultural land use, and I think that's going to be the main control. And eventually, we predict the global warming potential to be higher in the shelter belt than in the hedgerow, and the least will be in the silvopastoral system. Some of the methods, gas sampling, static gas chamber systems, and then measured in on the GC. The sampling was done in early April to mid-May in both 2014 and 2015, and some of the soil parameters measured, including soil organic carbon, that was data we used in this analysis was only based on 0 to 10 centimeters, and soil temperature and moisture content measurements. The soil temperature and the water content data, this is the 2014, basically we find the land use system to have a significant impact on soil temperature. We didn't really see much of a land use or agriculture system impact on soil moisture. Moisture-wise, there was a fairly high temporal variation. The temporal variation obviously is fairly large for temperature as well. Temperature and moisture content in 2015, really similar results to 2014. So this is a CO2 emission or CO2 flux data for 2014. As we can see that the both agricultural system had a significant impact on the CO2 emission, but not by land use type. And temperature had a significant impact on the CO2 emission in 2014. And we also find a significant agroforestry by land use type interaction. And so the focus here is on the main CO2 emission rates in 2014. Because of that lack of interaction, we plotted the agroforestry system versus the land use inferences or the effects. And so the hypothesis, unfortunately, is only partly supported. Well, we only found a difference between the silvopastoral system and the hedgerow and the shelter belt system. So the respiration or CO2 respiration was higher in the silvopastoral system, and there was no difference between the hedgerow and the shelter belt. There was no difference between the two land use systems among the three agricultural systems. So that hypothesis about land use was not supported. CO2 flux in 2015, quite different because we find an agricultural system by land use interaction, and so the interaction is being plotted for the mean CO2 emission rate. There was no difference between the herbland and the tree area for silvopastoral system, but we did find significantly higher CO2 emission in the treat area in the herbland, in the hedgerow and in the shelter belt system. So again, the hypothesis was only partially supported about the agroforestry and land use system influences on CO2 emission. We did the multiple regression analysis, and about more than 50% of the relation could be explained by temperature and the amount of carbon contained in 0 to 10 centimeter soil. And so that's obviously a really good indication that temperature and soil organic carbon content had a fairly large control on CO2 emissions from these systems. In terms of the methane emission, we find, this is 2014, we didn't find significant agroforestry by land use interaction. And so the mean data across the growing season, we see the methane uptake, so this is the negative value, we can call this as the uptake or a reduction in the methane concentration over time. The uptake rate was much higher in the silvopastoral system than in the shelter belt and the hedgerow system. There were significant differences between the two land uses. The methane uptake was higher in the treat area than in the agricultural area. So in terms of the land use, the hypothesis was accepted, and in terms of the agricultural systems, the hypothesis was only partially accepted with no difference between the shelter belt and the hedgerow system. Really similar to the CO2 emission data in 2015, we again find significant interactions between agricultural systems and the land uses. Again, here we didn't find methane flux or methane uptake differences between the two land uses in the silvopastoral system, but the uptake was higher in the treat area than in the agricultural area in both the hedgerow and the shelter belt system. And we did the regression analysis. Again, the percent of the variation that could be explained by either the temperature and carbon together or the water content of the carbon, unfortunately, the percent explained was much lower than the CO2. And so that may be indicating that other factors that we didn't, unfortunately, measure was more having a greater impact on methane uptake in the system. The last one about nitrous oxide fluxes, this is the 2014 data, different from the CO2 or the methane uptake data. The nitrous oxide fluxes, we find a significant interaction between agriculture and land use for 2014, and really similar, unfortunately, to the earlier data, that there was no difference in terms of nitrous oxide emissions between the herbland and the treat area for the silvopastoral system. For the hedgerow and the shelter, there was no difference in the shelter belt system between the two land uses either, but in the herb, in the hedgerow, the nitrous oxide flux or emission was much higher in the herbland or in the agricultural production system than in the trees. So the hypotheses were really only accepted for the hedgerow, and there was not, only for the hedgerow. For the nitrous oxide emission in 2015, it's been reversed, so we didn't find any significant interaction between agroforestry and the land use systems. So for the differences between the agricultural systems, the N2O flux was higher in hedgerow, and which is the same as in the shelter belt, and then higher than in the silvopastoral system. Likely, again, because in the silvopastoral system there was no nitrogen added, while in the hedgerow and the shelter belt system we're dealing with agricultural production systems in the agricultural land use, and there was nitrogen added, so that caused the nitrous oxide emission to be higher. And between the herbland and the trees, much higher N2O emissions from the herbland or from the agricultural production system, again, largely because of the nitrogen fertilizer application. Again, the percent of the variation that could be explained by the three parameters, temperature, water content, and carbon content was relatively low. And we did calculate the global warming potential based on all three greenhouse gases. How much time do I have? already run out of time. So I guess I'm probably going to just skip on this. One of the key messages that is when we did calculate the global warming potential based on the carbon basis, we found that the carbon, the global warming potential to be much higher than in the agricultural land use and in the trade area. So just to quickly conclude this presentation, trees in the agricultural landscape generally increase CO2 emission and methane uptake, but reduce nitrous oxide emission during the spring thaw. Greenhouse gas emissions during the spring thaw was smaller than carbon sequestration by the trees. Unfortunately, I didn't present the data on this. It was based on earlier work, based on data from earlier research, and the global warming potential per soil organic carbon content was lower in the tree areas than in the herbland or in the agricultural production system. And the overall impact of trees on global warming potential was low due to the short duration of the spring thaw relative to the large greenhouse gas emission during the growing season. But unfortunately, the numbers are still quite significant, so we should not ignore the greenhouse gas emissions during the spring thaw period. And so some acknowledgments, and I probably don't have time to answer questions. All right. Any questions? Yeah.
Scott, could you talk a little bit about qualitatively about the differences between the species in those forests and maybe about the densities in the creek? You know, I looked from your photos, you might have been comparing a deciduous shelter belt or a coniferous shelter belt and a deciduous forest, and the agroforestry system looked like alder and columbia as far as I was concerned. Could you just talk a little bit about some of those species differences?
Right. That's a good question. And I guess the species compositions are somewhat different between the hedgerow and the shelter belt. The shelter belt system was mostly based on either aspen or white spruce. While the hedgerows, the species composition, I mean, the shelter belt obviously would be quite monocultural, like if it would be one species. But the hedgerow would be natural vegetation, so it could be a combination of different species in the hedgerow. But I guess our argument is that because we've used 12 sites across the region, and so we wanted the results to be applicable across a wider region. And so have these vegetation composition differences and still be able to make some conclusions, I think will be more valid by just selecting the same species, which obviously is not going to be really easy to achieve. So there's obviously noise coming from the differences between the species compositions and so forth. And,
yeah. I wonder if you could comment on what the climate would like during your sampling period. Was it representative of the average?
I wish Jin Hub is here, so I don't really have the data for that. Yeah, and you have another one? Mm-hmm. Right. That's a good question as well. So the question here is, what if we measure the greenhouse gas emissions 5 meters away from the shelter belt or the hedgerow system and so forth? We got these questions before, and obviously the main limitation is how many sites can we sample. It would be nice to have a subsequent gradient within the trees and a few meters away, and perhaps even like in agriculture systems, we typically talk about the influence of the trees in terms of the tree height. The influence could be up to 20, 30 tree height. And so it would be nice to establish a gradient, but obviously the main limitation is the funding and the amount of manpower available. So this is obviously it's just a rough estimation or approximation using the tree area and 30 meters or 2 to 3 tree heights away from the tree area as approximation for the agriculture system. That's a good question as well. In terms of applications for landowners, whether they should be planting more trees and removing agricultural land from agriculture and into forestry, I guess it depends. Well, you know, if we consider some of the other ecological effects from planting the trees, in the past, the PFIA within the Canadian government, they were encouraging tree planting in Western Canada as a form of improving soil quality in terms of reducing wind speed and reducing soil and water erosion and so forth. And so if we consider all these together, and if agriculture is not doing well and carbon can be sold for 50 tons of CO2 equivalent, there may be value to be gained or economic gain to be achieved, right? And particularly if you are talking about land that's really not the more fertile, marginal land. And so the message obviously is if we can convert some of these marginal land and into forestry, there's benefit for increasing carbon sequestration and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Not necessarily from this particular presentation, because we were only dealing with the spring soil period. But when we put all the data together, adding the data from the growing season, the benefit of the agriculture system was quite obvious.
And with that, let's thank
Scott.
Like I said, our current speaker was unable to make it, so we'll resume again at 8:45 with Dr. Harris Adams.
A question for Mike.
Mike, take a stand.
My question is, NEON has a plan for managing their data, but for example, the data that you collect in your SOMOS study, is there a plan for that becoming available or becoming part of the NEON corporate database somehow or another at some point?
I think we will make that available. Our plan is to put it on ISTN, the National Soil Carbon Network database. But I think as we move forward, we'll continue to link other databases to NEON. We've already started to do that. So a good example would be, as I mentioned, we're starting to work with Ameriflex. And so our data is going to be available to users that are from the portal, especially if we're starting to work that together in efforts that, you know, we have network. Actually, we've got them processing all of our data, so it goes to people from NEON and other sites and everything all right. So I think we'll see more of that. We can get
What was your protocol to sample bulk density?
What is the protocol to sample? We're doing it in the field. Not yet.
How big?
Cores. How big are cores? Get the exact dimension.
Small?
Yeah, smaller. And then, yeah, I don't think we're doing any. I think for a little while we did some plot methods, but we aren't doing both
now. Are you aware how many of the NEON sites have rocks, like big things that cores won't go through occasionally?
Yeah,
cores, like this is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been generating the data almost off the site. So it's been important in 2 years that then you can be studying on the site, but we built a pretty sweet setup for getting the 2 meters in the front of the soil, we updated everything. We mapped it like a huge drill, a lot of sludge, a whole lot of snowmobiles.
Actually, we can probably have like 4 years. So, yeah, some sites are out. Thank you. Yeah. I had a question for Scott. Related to land, and I think it was in your coefficients, but I wasn't paying much attention. What percent of the difference between land use types relevant?
Can I go back to the data? Per carbon. So most of the global warming potential is attributed to the CO2. And so that caused the discrepancy between the prediction, which is the real data, because the rate of emission of nitrous oxide, even though it's 310 or something like that, times greater in terms of the global warming potential than CO2, but because the rate of emission was so much larger with the CO2, so most of the global warming potential was caused by the CO2, really small percentage by the nitrous oxide.